Good morning. As Tim said, my name's Brandon. If you're new, and several of you are, we're so glad you're here today. It was, if you'll allow me 1 minute of personal privilege. It was January 12th, 2014, and we started this endeavor up in the youth room. And I got put in a place that I wanted to try to be, and I was really excited and really green from needing to vomit, and also green in the metaphorical sense, young. And I had a sport coat on that day because I didn't know how to dress it, you know, and what this was going to do and be like. And after that sermon, which was really, really average, and y'all were so kind and just told me how good it was, my shirt was completely wet with sweat. And so I thought, man, this isn't going to work. And so you've allowed for 5 years me to dress down, and this has turned into a very comfortable place. You've allowed this manuscript preacher to use his notes, and the iPad has never failed so far. It's never gone out, which would have been, always been a little too anxious to get away from what I've prepared fully. So y'all have been so kind. This morning we're talking about being in a spiritual rut, and I was, you know, there's a little bit of pressure on the last time you'll get to address a group you love so much. And so I had this, like, 12 points of how you can not get in a spiritual rut and the things that you can do to stay out and of it. And then I realized, I don't believe any of that. I don't need to say that. And it's not that I didn't believe it, but what it kept hitting me with is that it wasn't the thing to do first. And so in addressing us together for the last time that I'll be in this spot, I want to tell you what I think you should do first when you're in a spiritual rut. It's where I hope to go first. It's where you've encouraged me to go first in the times that we've been in a rut in our family's lives. Psalm 41 and 2 says this: I waited patiently for the Lord. He inclined to me and heard my cry. He drew me up from the desolate pit out of the miry bog, and set my feet upon a rock, making my steps secure. David is saying this, and it comes from his heart, I believe. And David's a shepherd, as you might know. And one thing that's true about the desert land, the wilderness land in the Mideast, is that it doesn't rain a lot, as you know, in deserts, but it does rain in the area. They have to get rain, and it's concentrated in the mountain regions. And so what will happen is there'll be a ton of rain in the mountains, and it'll wash down the mountain, and it'll create these ruts, these wadis that are in the desert. And so in drier times, that's when the thunderstorms actually happen, that'll be where the shepherd has to bring the sheep down to get water. And what can be the case is that the soil is sticky, really sticky, to the point where the sheep and even the shepherd can get stuck in that mud. Actually, quite a few people die from drowning in the desert. I know it sounds weird, but it's with this phenomenon of the water rushing down from the mountain. And so when we understand that, looking at what David's writing here, we understand his language of miry bog. I feel like my feet are stuck, Lord, in this metaphor that he's using that people would, hearing him, would understand. So I ask us today, are our feet stuck for whatever reason? Do you feel anxious or tired or beaten down in a rut this morning? I offer you this story that you may or may not know. This is the story of Babette's Feast. So picture a small Scandinavian coastal village, a town of muddy streets and thatched roof houses. And in this setting, there's an old pastor, a Lutheran pastor, who leads a group of worshipers. And what few worldly pleasures are available in such a meager place, these worshipers, they reject. They do not enjoy them. They all wore black, simple clothing, and they ate a steady diet of cod and gruel, which was boiled bread with ale splashed in. They worshiped together and they sang songs about Jerusalem, fixing their eyes completely on the new Jerusalem. Life was merely a vehicle to tolerate en route to the new Jerusalem. And the pastor there had two daughters, Martine and Philippa, named after Martin Luther and his protege, Philip Melanchthon. And villagers were smitten with these two daughters. They were beauties. Martine actually caught the eye of a young army officer, but she resisted his pursuit of her. Here, I'm gonna use the mic over here. Getting me out of my comfort zone. Martine resisted him. And who could care for her aging father after all if she was to, you know, fall in love with him? He went on. He married royalty. Philippa, she had the voice of an angel, and it caught the ear of a Frenchman opera singer. I don't want to say this wrong. Achille Papin. He was up on the coast, and he was sick, and he had gone to the coastal village to on holiday to get better. And he heard Philippa singing in the street one day, and he came up to her and he said, "You have to let me teach you. You have the most beautiful voice, and if I can train you to sing properly, I promise you, you will have royalty lined up in Paris to come see you sing. You will be famous. You will be spending your nights dining in the world-renowned Café Anglais." She consented to a few lessons, but as she learned to sing and in the songs they were singing, they made her quite uneasy. She was singing about love, and she was getting joy from these songs. They were making her happy, and she didn't like that. And then she actually got quite close to Papin, and she confessed to her father, and he forbid her immediately from taking any more lessons, and Papin went back to Paris and left them there. Fast forward 15 years, the pastor has died, and the daughters are trying to carry on the worshiping community. But the community's not doing well. There are grudges held amongst the group. There are rumors of a 30-year affair within the group. There are a pair of older ladies who are very upset with each other, and they don't speak anymore, haven't spoken in a decade. They still meet weekly for worship, but only a few attend, and the music had lost its luster. Despite the problems, the pastor's daughters persist, and they still tried to keep it together. They doled out every day gruel and cod to the poor village. One rainy night, there was a thump at the sister's door, and a woman had collapsed on their doorstep, and she handed them a letter from Achille Papin. Her name was Babette, a widow who had had to flee from France. Achille put her on a boat that was bound for this small village in hopes that Babette would find Philippa and her sister Martine. The letter simply said, "Please take care of Babette. She can cook." No money to employ Babette. It felt weird to have a maid in this meager village. They agreed that although it felt weird, they needed to take her in. So the agreement became that she would do chores and help and live with the sisters. And the first time Martine showed her how to split cod and boil the bread, her nose curled up and she winced badly, but she didn't push back. She cooked, she acquiesced, she cleaned, she helped feed the poor in the village. She even helped with the worship gathering. She was winsome and she was kind. She breathed life, Babette did, into this stagnant community. And since Babette never referred to her life in France, they were all extremely shocked when she, 12 years into her time there, got a letter from France. And as she read the letter, she couldn't keep the smile off of her face, because what had happened is one of Babette's friends in Paris had continued to renew her lottery number. And 12 years later, she won 10,000 francs. Winning the lottery happened to coincide with the sisters starting to plan a sort of a celebration for this meager town for their father, the anniversary of their father's 100th birthday, what would have been his 100th birthday. And Babette, knowing this was the case, she came to them with a request. She said, "I've asked nothing in 12 years. You have to grant me this one request. You have to let me cook dinner for your father's birthday anniversary celebration. I want to prepare a real French dinner for you all." So they were uncomfortable, the sisters, but they agreed. She hadn't asked anything of them in 12 years, so they let her do it. So Babette made provisions, and the townspeople, they didn't know what quite to make of all the boats docking and bringing in provisions
for the dinner, crates of small birds and cases of champagne, an entire cow, vegetables, truffles, pheasants, ham, strange sea creatures, a tortoise that was literally alive still came off of a boat, and the kitchen now firmly belonged to Babette. She was in her element, but the sisters were concerned, and they convened the church and said, "This is becoming much too extravagant. What should we do?" And they agreed that they would carry on with the dinner and the plans out of respect for Babette, but they were not going to enjoy it. They were digging their heels in. After all, tongues were meant for praise and thanksgiving, not for indulging in exotic tastes. It snowed on December the 15th, the day of the dinner, brightening the dull village with a gloss of white. The villagers were delighted to learn that a guest was going to join them, a 90-year-old woman who was escorted by her nephew, the cavalry officer who had courted Martine, who now was serving as a general in the royal palace. Now, Babette had somehow scrounged together enough china to offer the place settings. The room was decorated with evergreens. It was truly lovely. When the meal began, the villagers, thinking of their agreement, they set eager to not show any emotion. But the general was not part of that collusion. And when he sipped the soup, he literally shouted with laughter, swearing it was turtle soup, but where could you find such a delicacy on this far northern coast? And then out came the next course, and brilliant, he exclaimed. Everyone else was eating the same rare delicacies without expression, though. The general seemed to be the only one who was appreciating what was before him. And although the collusion continued, the meal did start, y'all, to have a magical effect on those who were gathered to eat. Their blood warmed, their tongues loosened. They spoke of the good old days when their pastor was alive. They spoke of that Christmas when the bay had frozen over. The brother who had cheated another brother in a shady business deal confessed. The two women who hadn't talked in 10 years, they were seen chatting. A woman belched, and the man next to her shouted, "Hallelujah." The general couldn't stop talking about the meal. When the main course was served, which was quail, the general exclaimed he had only had such a fine dish in one place in the world, the Café Anglais in Paris, the restaurant once renowned for a woman chef. Overwhelmed and perhaps a bit tipsy, the general struck his glass with his spoon and rose to make a speech. A skilled orator, the general actually struggled to give words to the evening. He simply marveled at how blessed they all were to have such an experience. His message was one of grace. Whether the others fully understood the general's speech or not, their vain illusions of the earth were beginning to be broken down that night. And they began, in their persistence to be ascetic, they began to see God's kingdom as it actually was. And they went outside and they looked up at the sky, which was full of stars, offering a canvas against the snow of a glistening white landscape. Again, Dallas Willard says, "The gospel is less about how to get into the kingdom of heaven after you die, and more about how to live in the kingdom of heaven before you die." Matthew 6, Jesus offers these words, beginning in verse 19. "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust consume and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust consumes and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Verse 22, "The eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness?" So if your eyes are bad, you don't see very well. I attest to that. I've had a month of struggle with my eyes, and it's painful to not see very well. The metaphor Jesus is making here is an apt one for me. If the light within you is darkness, that darkness is like super darkness. You meet the greatest darkness when the thing you thought was light is just the opposite. Think of it like this. We get stuck in a rut, perhaps the biggest rut, when we do the wrong thing thinking that it is right. Nothing is worse, Jesus is saying, than investing in something so much that won't last and thinking all of the time it's something that is eternal. Perhaps like living ascetic lives in a small Scandinavian fishing village when you could have been enjoying life. Friends, that's how the world and the deceiver deceives us. That's what Jesus means by the greatest darkness. But the light and what the light exposes for us is that regardless of who we are or what we have done or what circumstances we find ourselves in this morning, we can and should praise God. Praise that comes deep from within us. Come thou fount of every blessing as a response to what God has done, to who God is, that God has allowed for us today to be full of light. Jesus was full of light. My goodness, Jesus was full of light. And his life was not easy. Jesus went through Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the good news of the kingdom and curing every disease and sickness among the people. So his fame spread throughout all Syria, and they brought to him all the sick, those who were afflicted with various diseases and pains, demoniacs, epileptics, and paralytics. And he cured them, and great crowds followed him. Those with Jesus, that followed Jesus, that were said to have been cursed, Jesus attracted these hurting, cast-aside people. He wanted them. He taught them. He loved them. And he did not stop there. He affirmed them. He said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they'll be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. They'll be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven." There's nothing about the gospel, y'all, that says, do this and you will be blessed. Jesus here and all throughout the Sermon on the Mount is describing what life is like. You are already blessed. You are already blessed. So we don't have to store up our treasure to be important. Hear me, you're important. I've talked with my dad a lot in the last month. This has been emotional. Like, this has not been easy. I trust that you believe me on that. And part of what's not been easy about this is I'm being called to a place where I need to do a good job. And I need to do a good job by trusting God that God will help, you know, us do a good job there. And I'm an Enneagram 9, so I'm a little bit of a defeatist and quickly can put myself down. And so I'm talking with my dad and I'm saying, I'm not comfortable even with people believing in me. I don't think. I'm not important enough to receive all these nice words. And Dad said, "Stop there. That's ridiculous. It's not that you're not important, Brandon. It's that everybody else is too." I love that. So if you're in a rut today, a miry bog, Jesus offers the good news of the gospel here to the very people in the world who were projected to be in a rut. Those in power too often, subconsciously or consciously, subdue those who are different, who are diseased, who are pained, who are paralyzed, who are mentally ill, who are not from here, who are gay. Fill in the blank. On the way to church this morning, there was a man who was not going to make it across the street in his wheelchair before the light turned. And I just can't, how hard is his day? I don't know. It's harder than mine. And Jesus said, "I'm giving you, brother, this good news. And it's going to change you. It's going to make you more like me. It's going to make you more like you were made to be." And that is where joy is. It's not in all that we may or may not attain in this world. It's in understanding whose we are in Christ. It's in encompassing, you know, taking in these words, these beatitudes, and believing them. When the greatest darkness blinds us, we end up just storing up more earthly treasure in our attempts to do what God is asking us to do in order to please God. So we're not planning to build a building here, to erect a beautiful building so that the world can believe that God too is beautiful. Or because we want to attract a ton of young families into our bright, new, shiny space. Nothing is wrong with a bright, shiny space, a beautiful building, a beautiful home, a beautiful shirt, two beautiful sisters. Nothing is wrong with attracting many young families or old families or anybody's, for that matter. But our building has to be accompanied by a faith family filled with people who love people, who are inspired to continue the life and work of Jesus throughout the world. Here's the deal. We can build a shiny, big new house. There's nothing wrong with it. Buildings need updating. I pray this church sees several more building projects because we continue to do the life and the work of Jesus here for hundreds of more years. And structures do get old. But the way to reach people is people. Specifically, people who follow Jesus and cause others to want to do the same. Madeline L'Engle says this: we draw people to Christ not by loudly discrediting what they believe, by telling them how wrong they are and how right we are, but by showing them a light that is so lovely that they want with all their hearts to know the source of it. I don't think people in the Scandinavian fishing village really recognize the source of their salvation. The source is Jesus, and grace is free. For our church to flourish the way we hope it will, the key is found in these Beatitudes, in the Sermon on the Mount. We have to see each other as God sees us. We have to see others as God sees them. We have to put others before ourselves. And when living like this is something that God requires of us, we'll fail. We will resent one another, and we will fail. When we will dwindle to 11 people. We cannot earn God's blessing. We have it, so we must live like it. Grace is free. It is pure gift. A story of grace cost the giver everything. It cost those who receive it nothing. But in them, it produces inexpressible joy. And lives that follow after Jesus with all their heart and their soul and their mind, their strength. The townspeople, after they finished dinner, I said they walked outside. And what they did is they gathered around the fountain and they refound the fervor they had for the songs of their faith. And they joined hands and they sang and they smiled. Thought of their God and what God has done. So we're going to do that now together.